Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Today we'll hear three brief talks by one of our most brilliant political analysts, Professor Noam Chomsky. He talks about how intellectuals mostly support and seldom critique the establishment. He talks about what's wrong with the economy. And he talks about the best solution for Palestine. I hope you'll stay tuned. Professor Noam Chomsky is that rare scholar and intellectual who dares to speak truth to power, as the saying goes. In hundreds of speeches, interviews, books, and articles, he has exposed the lies, hypocrisies, and distortions of history that pass for U.S. foreign and domestic policy. Chomsky's public lectures are long, complex, full of historical details, and intricately constructed. So it's hard to find, say, a 20-minute self-contained chunk that one can just cut out of a lecture and broadcast by itself. You've really got to listen to his whole hour-long talk in one sitting. It's an hour well spent, but not so good for half-hour radio programs. So a video I found a few months back is a rare treat. Six well-known writers had each submitted a question, and Chomsky addresses each question in turn. Voila! Six mini-lectures! The question and answer took place in March of 2011, back in the early days of the Arab Spring, 6 months before Occupy Wall Street. We broadcast one of these talks a few months back, and we'll have time for three more today. First, he responds to a question by Chris Hedges on intellectuals abandoning the search for truth and becoming prostitute propagandists for established power. Here is his reply.
And I understand his feelings and share them, but I don't know what the loss was. When was it ever true? At no time that I can remember. The term intellectual came into pretty common usage in the modern sense at the time of the Dreyfusards. They were a small minority, a small, vilified minority. The mass of intellectuals supported state power. During the First World War, shortly afterwards, the intellectuals of every one of the countries passionately supported their own state and its own violence. Now, there were a handful of exceptions, like Bertrand Russell in England, or Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht in Germany, or Eugene Debs in the United States. They were all in jail. They were a margin, and they were in prison. So, yes, they were there. In the John Dewey circle, the liberal intellectuals in the United States, passionately pro-war, there was one member, Randolph Bourne, who didn't go along with it. He wasn't put in jail. The United States is a pretty free country. But he was thrown out of the journals, you know, and was intellectually exiled and so on. That's the way it's always been. During the, 1960s, big activist period, you take a careful look. Intellectuals were very supportive of Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement as long as he was attacking somebody else. As long as the civil rights movement was going after racist sheriffs in Alabama, that was wonderful. You know, everybody praised it, you know. We're talking big, high rhetoric and so on. As soon as he turned to class issues, he was marginalized and suppressed. People tend to forget that he was killed when he was taking part in a sanitation worker strike and on his way to Washington to help organize a poor people's movement. Well, that crosses the boundary. That goes after us. It goes after privilege in the North and so on. So the intellectuals disappeared. With regard to the Vietnam War, it was exactly the same thing. There was almost no, among known, you know, there was of course people on the fringes, there were young people and so on. But among well-known intellectuals, practically nothing. At the very end, after the Tet Offensive in 1968, when the business community turned against the war, then you started getting a drifting of people saying, yes, I was always a long-time anti-war activist, no trace of it or whatever. But that's, in fact, you can take this back to the earliest history. I go back to classical Greece. Who drank the hemlock? A guy was accused of corrupting the youth of Athens with false gods. Take the biblical records. They didn't have the term intellectual, but they had a term which meant what we mean by intellectual. It's called prophet. It's a bad translation of an obscure Hebrew word. Well, there were so-called prophets, intellectuals, who carried out geopolitical critique, condemned the king for bringing about disaster, condemned the king's crimes, called for mercy for widows and orphans, and so on, what we would call dissident intellectuals. How are they treated? They were denounced as haters of Israel. It's the exact phrase that was used. It's the origins of the phrase self-hating Jew in the modern period. They were imprisoned, driven into the desert, and so on. There were intellectuals who were praised, the flatterers at the court. Centuries later, they were called false prophets, but not at the time. And that's almost the entire history since. There are few exceptions. In the modern period, the one major exception I know is actually Turkey. It's the only country I know where leading prominent artists, academics, journalists, publishers, very broad range of intellectuals, and not only condemn the crimes of the state, but are involved in constant civil disobedience against them, facing, often enduring, pretty severe punishment. I have to laugh when I come to Europe and hear people complaining about how the Turks aren't civilized enough to join our advanced society. You could learn some lessons from Turkey, but that's pretty unusual. In fact, it's so unusual that it's barely known. You can't bring it up. But aside from the word loss, I think Chris Hedges' comments are accurate, but I just can't perceive any loss. I think it's about the same as it's always been. And in fact, the way dissident intellectuals are treated, of course, does vary. So in the United States, let's say, maybe they're vilified or something. In the old Soviet Union, say in Czechoslovakia in the 1960s and 70s, they could be imprisoned, like Havel was in prison. If you were in American domains at that time, like El Salvador, you get your brains blown out by an elite battalion trained in the U.S. Special Warfare School. So yes, people are treated differently, depending on the country.
That was Noam Chomsky, giving a typical Noam Chomsky reply, which is, this sort of thing has been going on for many, many years. And the brilliance of his answer lies in the many specific examples that he then rattles off. Next, a question from Paul Laverty on economic inequality and alternatives to capitalism. Chomsky talks about that. Then he brilliantly explains our current financial crisis. Then he scolds his fellow progressives for not focusing enough on the sufferings of the working class. Gay marriage may be a worthy cause, he says, but millions of workers losing their jobs is really a more pressing issue. Here's Noam Chomsky.
Certainly I can imagine it, and in fact there have been successful experiments with it, some of them right now. None of them are utopia, none of them would I or you or others would aspire to, but they're not insignificant. Like, take, say, the Mondragon system in Spain. It's not worker-managed, but it's worker-owned. It's a form of cooperative, quite successful, very broad, lots of problems, but quite real. If you look around the United States, there are probably hundreds of self-managed enterprises, not huge. Some of them are pretty large, but huge. They're successful. Take, say, Egypt right now. Now, one of the interesting things that's happening in Egypt is that the labor movement, which has been very militant for years, as I mentioned, this is not an uprising out of nothing. They've now apparently, it's hard to get information because not covered very well, but actually I think Amir Haas has been reporting this, that some of the industrial centers, like again the Mahalla, a big industrial center. Apparently workers have taken over the enterprises and are managing them themselves. Well, if that's true, that would be the beginning of a revolution, go back to John Berger's words. So yes, it's certainly feasible. What's been lacking, the comment about the inequality is very real. I don't know the detailed statistics for other countries, but in the United States, where I know it, inequality is back to the highest level it's ever been in history, the 1920s. But that's misleading, because the inequality in the United States is highly concentrated. It's mostly in the top fraction of 1% of the population. You take a look at the income distribution, it goes very sharply up towards the high end, and literally 0.1% of the population now has extraordinary wealth. In fact, that's driving the inequality. If you take that part away, it's unequal, but not totally out of sight. Who are they? They're hedge fund managers, CEOs, bankers, and so on. Well, something quite significant has been happening. Since the 1970s, the economy has changed significantly. It's been financialized. Go back to, say, 1970, financial institutions, you know, banks, investment firms, were a small percentage of corporate profits. Now, they're, in 2007, they reached 40%. They don't benefit the economy. In fact, they probably harm the economy. There's no central social utility to them, but they're powerful. And with economic power comes political power, pretty obvious reasons. So they have gained extensive political power. For example, it's financial institutions that put Obama into office, pretty much. That's where most of his funding came from. With political power comes the opportunity to modify the legislative system, and they've been doing it. So since the 1980s mainly, fiscal policies have been changed, say tax policies, to ensure rapid concentration, very high concentration of wealth. Rules of corporate governance have been changed. They allow, for example, the CEO of a corporation to select the board that determines his salary. Well, you can imagine what the consequences of that are. Actually, you read them in the front pages of the newspapers every day about the huge bonuses being given to management. That's where that comes from. The regulation has collapsed with very striking effects. New Deal regulation. Instantly, this generalizes to the rest of the world. I'm talking about the United States because I know it better. New Deal regulation prevented any financial crises up until the 1980s, really. In the 1970s, it started to be dismantled. Since the 1980s, crisis after crisis, several during the Reagan years, pretty serious ones. In fact, Reagan left office with the worst financial crisis since the Depression, the savings and loan, then came Clinton, then the tech crisis, then finally this housing crisis, $8 trillion of fake money disappeared, devastating the economy. Well, all of these are political decisions. And meanwhile, the cost of campaigning went way up. And that compels the parties to climb pretty deep into the pockets of the corporate sector. That's where the money is. The next election, 2012, is expected to cost about $2 billion. You take a look at the Obama administration, you notice he's staffing the government right now with executives. You know, they're the ones who have the access to the corporate funding that's going to buy the election. Elections are just becoming farces, you know, run by public relations industry, their marketing efforts, and they kind of say it openly. But in fact, Obama won the award from the advertising industry for the best marketing campaign of 2008. They know exactly what's going on. All of this is a kind of a vicious cycle. Increased concentration of wealth, increased political power, it acts to further increase wealth. Why is there no reaction? Actually, there is a reaction. Right now, for the first time, what's going on in Wisconsin is a very significant reaction. There are tens of thousands of people in the streets, day after day, with a lot of popular support, maybe two-thirds of the population supporting them. They're trying to defend labor rights, the right of collective bargaining, which is under attack. I mean, the business world understands very well that the one barrier to this total corporate tyranny is the organized workers' movement. So that's got to be destroyed. But labor history in the United States has been extremely violent, more so than in Europe. And there have been effort after effort to wipe out the unions. They keep reviving. Now is a major one going on, but it's being resisted. It's being resisted by large popular movements. Well, where's the left? Actually, what's happened to the left is interesting. Since the 1960s, when there was a big revival, there is quite an activist left. There are more young activists now than there were in the 60s, but the issues have changed. The issues are what are sometimes called post-materialist. They're important issues. Don't denigrate them. So gay rights, environmental rights, women's rights, you know, all really important things. But they don't reach to the concerns of the people who are living under depression-level unemployment. They don't reach to the 20% of the population, roughly, who need food stamps. There hasn't been that kind of outreach and organizing. So when the protest started in Wisconsin a couple of weeks ago, there was practically no left initiative. I mean, a couple of well-known figures came in to give talks, but it was not organized by the left groups who ought to be right at the heart of it. It's there, and it better come, or else we're in bad trouble. But while left activism is significant, very significant, it's pretty much divorced from the daily struggles for survival and the decent life of most of the population. And that's a gap that has to be overcome somehow.
Finally, a question by Alice Walker on the crisis of Palestine, illegally occupied by Israel for close to a half century now. Walker asks, everyone talks about a two-state solution. Why not a one-state solution? Chomsky agrees that a one-state solution would be better. But, he says, the biggest problem is that the United States has never wanted any solution. Strong words, but well argued. Here's Noam Chomsky.
It's now about 70 years that I've been advocating for what in the recent reincarnation is called a one-state settlement. A one-state settlement notice, not solution. A one-state settlement used to be called a binational settlement. And if you think about it, yes, it'll have to be binational settlement. So that's what I was when I was a young activist in the 1940s, opposed to a Jewish state. That was what we were struggling for, a binational state, a one-state settlement. And that's continued without a break. And it's kind of hard to miss. Since the 1960s, a series of books, a huge number of articles, constant talks all the time, thousands of them, interviews, all the same, trying to work for a binational settlement, opposition to a Jewish state. Done a ton of work on this, activist work, writing, and so on. But it's not just a slogan. It's not just a slogan, let's all live together happily. It's trying to look at the problem seriously. If you're serious about it, you ask, how do we get there? You ask, what are the steps that will take us there? Not just, wouldn't it be nice if we had peace? You know, that's easy. How do we get there? Well, you know, that depends on circumstances, like all tactical choices. So in the pre-1948 period, it was straightforward. So we don't want a Jewish state. Let's have a binational state. 48 to 67, you couldn't sensibly take that position. You're talking to yourself. In 1967, it opened up again. There was an opportunity in 67 to move towards some kind of a federal system which could then proceed further to closer integration, maybe become a true binational secular state. And in fact, at that time, 67 on, I was writing about it all over the place. Like I said, books, articles, interviews, and so on. Up till about 1975, 1975 Palestinian nationalism crystallized and appeared on the agenda, and the PLO turned to a two-state settlement, the huge, overwhelming international consensus by that time for two-state settlement in the form that everyone knows. 67 to 75, it was possible to advocate for it directly, and it was anathema, hated, you know, denounced, because it was threatening. It was threatening because it could be fulfilled, and that would harm policy formation. So, you know, if it was noticed at all, it was denounced and vilified. 75 on, you can still maintain the position, but you have to face reality. It's going to have to be achieved in stages. And there's only one proposal that I've ever heard, other than, yeah, let's all live in peace together. The one proposal that I know is, if I have to listen, if there's another one, is begin with the international consensus, two-state settlement. It would reduce the level of violence, cycle of violence. It would open up possibilities for a closer interaction, which already to some extent takes place, even in today's circumstances, commercial, cultural, other forms of interaction. Now, that could lead to erosion of boundaries. It could move on to closer integration, and maybe something like the old concept of a binational state. Now, I call that a settlement because I don't think that's the end of the road. I don't see any particular reason to worship imperialist boundaries. My wife and I, back when we were students, were backpacking up in northern Israel and happened to cross into Lebanon because there's no marked border. You know, somebody finally yelled at us and said, you better get back. But why should there be a border there? It was imposed by British and French violence. You should move towards a closer integration of the whole region. No state settlement, if you want the word. And there's plenty wrong with states anyway. Why should we worship state structures? They should be eroded. So it's a step. It's a series of steps. Now, if anyone can think of another way to get there, then they ought to tell us. We could listen to it and talk about it. But I don't know of any other way. So what you end up with, at least I end up with, what I've been writing and speaking about, is something that's too complex to put on a Twitter message. And in this age, that means it doesn't exist. You have to support both the two-state and the one-state solution, settlement, not solution. You support both of them, because one of them is the path to getting to the other. If you don't make the first move, you're not going to get anywhere. Now, Alice Walker says Israel wouldn't won't accept a two-state settlement, if she's right. A fortiori is not going to accept the one-state settlement. So if that argument has any force, her proposal is out the window. Mine too. By the same argument, you could show there could never be an end to apartheid. White nationalists would never accept an end to apartheid, which was true. Okay, therefore, let's give up the anti-apartheid struggle. Indonesia would never give up East Timor. In fact, the generals said so loudly. It's our province. We're going to keep it. And that would have been true if actions were taken in a vacuum. But they're not taken in a vacuum. There are other factors involved. And one factor, which is significant, and in fact in these cases decisive, is U.S. policy. Well, that's not graven in stone. When U.S. policy shifted on Indonesia and East Timor, it literally took one phrase from President Clinton to get the Indonesian generals out. At one point he said, it's over. They withdrew. In the case of apartheid, it's a little more complicated. Cuba played a big role. Cuba drove South Africans out of Namibia, for example, and protected Angola and so on. That had a big impact. But it was when the U.S. changed policy around 1990, there was a change of policy. It was at that point that apartheid collapsed. Now, in the case of Israel, it's just the U.S. is decisive. I mean, Israel can't do anything except what the U.S. Supports. It gives diplomatic, military, economic, ideological support. If that prop is pulled out, they do what the U.S. says. In fact, that's happened over and over. So yes, it's true that if they were acting in a vacuum, they'd never accept anything but what they're now doing, you know, taking over, you know, Gaza, prison, take over as much of the occupied territories as you want. Yeah, they'll continue. But they're not acting in a vacuum. There are things we can do, as in other cases, to change it. And in that case, I think you can consider and even lay out a plan for a move towards a one-state settlement as a step towards something even better, which can go on. You know, but as far as I can see, the only way to do that is by supporting the international consensus as a first step, a step to be a prelude to further steps. And that means very concrete actions. We don't have to talk about, we don't have to have a seminar in which we discuss, abstract possibilities. There are very concrete moves that can be made. So, for example, withdrawal of the IDF, the Israeli army, from the West Bank. Well, that's a concrete proposal. And there are steps that can be taken to implement it. For example, Amnesty International, which is hardly a revolutionary organization, called for an arms embargo on Israel. Well, if the United States and Britain, France, others could be, if the public could compel the governments to accept that proposal as an arms embargo, unless you pull your army out of the West Bank, that would have an effect. Other actions can too. If the army's pulled out of the West Bank, the settlers are going to go with them. They'll climb into the lorries provided to them and move from their subsidized homes in the West Bank to subsidized homes in Israel, just like they did in Gaza when they got the order. Some will probably remain, but that's okay. They want to remain in a Palestinian state. That's their business. So there are quite concrete things that can be done. It's not going to be like snapping your fingers, but not beyond the kinds of things that have happened elsewhere when policy of the great powers changed, primarily the U.S.
Professor Chomsky, thank you very much.
And with those words on Palestine, we conclude our three mini-lectures by Noam Chomsky on the world today. And I thank you for listening to New World Notes. Our free weekly email newsletter is yours for the asking. It'll let you know what's coming up in each weekly installment of our show. If you'd like to subscribe, just send me an email telling me you want to. And you'll find my email address at our website, which is newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Once again, that's newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, advising illegitimi non-carborundum. Try to speak the truth, and please tune in again next week. Peace.